Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. We're heading towards the end of December. Who will be top at Christmas? We'll find out on Saturday when Arsenal travel to Anfield to take on Liverpool. A win would mean we go into the Christmas period top of the table, for all that that entails. I think a draw keeps us there as well, but I think if you asked any Arsenal fan what their ideal Christmas present would be, they would eschew all kinds of gifts, all kinds of deodorant sets and socks and whatever else, for 3 points against Liverpool on Saturday. That is a game we'll talk about a little bit today. But just to give you an idea of what's coming over the next couple of days, we're going to put this out today, Thursday. Tomorrow, Friday, we will have a Liverpool preview podcast for you over on Patreon, patreon.com/arseblog. The game, of course, is on Saturday night, Saturday evening anyway. And on Christmas Eve, no scrooging here. When it comes to podcasts, we will have an Arsecast extra for you on Christmas Eve. So hopefully it is a very festive, goodly morning and we can jingle our bells all the way to the top of the table. And fingers crossed we can stay there for the rest of the season. For now, though, we have other things to talk about. Mikel Arteta's 4-year anniversary at Arsenal, for one. We'll discuss the impact that he has had on this club since his arrival in December 2019. Plus, there's been stuff this week about the European Super League. Also, the FIFA Club World Cup, the demands on players grow and grow and grow. So those are the topics that we will delve into. And with me to do that, delighted to welcome back, it is Andrew Allen. Hello, Andrew.
Hello there. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. We're certainly heading in the right direction. It's 21st of December, and there is a big game coming up this weekend, which we might touch on throughout this conversation. Arsenal travelling to Anfield, of course, to take on Liverpool and hoping to go into Christmas top of the table. But let's start elsewhere today, and there was noise around the Super League and a decision that was made by the European Court of Justice about the European Super League, ruling that the UEFA and I think FIFA as well, their guidelines, their rules went against European law. What actual difference it makes, I'm not quite sure. I was reading a piece just before we came on from Miguel Delaney in The Independent, who says the project can go ahead, but it needs to get permission to get set up by UEFA. Has much changed, do you think, or is this maybe the first little fracture in what's going on in terms of the people who run the game? Like, could we be heading for a PGA Tour, LIV Tour kind of scenario here where clubs will play in their domestic leagues, but you know, in Europe, they may choose a UEFA competition or they may choose a Super League competition?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in theory, that's possible. I mean, I think judging by the reaction of supporters today, there's a sense of kind of Super League fatigue, whereas there was a lot of, you know, anti-energy when it first came to light a couple of years ago. I just don't really see it getting off the ground, certainly not getting off the ground anytime soon. Obviously, there's all sorts of hoops that they need to jump through to get it moving. But also just watching the clubs one by one now coming out, Manchester United have released a statement saying that they're committed to UEFA. We've seen a couple of the German clubs, a couple of the other Spanish clubs. I mean, really, it's, you know, Florentino Perez may think he's got UEFA on the run, but I'm not sure that anybody else necessarily feels that way at this point. I think for Perez, this is all very, very personal. He seems to sort of think he's some kind of footballing freedom fighter, but I'm not sure that there's that many people out there who are asking for them, you know, for him to fight on their behalf. Obviously, he's in it for Real Madrid. Obviously, Real Madrid, Barcelona, and Juventus, who are the three clubs who kind of were a little bit more stuck in with the original Super League ideas, are desperate for something that brings in the riches that Premier League clubs have. And I just don't see the Premier League clubs, given the reaction that happened last time, given that there's an independent regulator coming in soon, given the potential punishments that they basically agreed to off the back of, you know, last time, which include things like a 30-point deduction and, you know, potential big fines, I just don't see the Premier League clubs getting involved.
Well, yeah, the Premier League released a statement this afternoon saying this is a significant ruling. We will now fully examine its implications for the game. The ruling does not endorse the so-called European Super League, in inverted commas, and the Premier League continues to reject any such concept, which I think is a fairly clear message, from the Premier League.
I mean, when you look at the actual, you know, what they're proposing, you know, a three-tiered league system, something that's, mirrored by the a proposal for the women's game as well. Includes the kind of promotion and relegation that the original idea did not. But when you actually dig a little deeper and realize that if you're in the top tier, you'd have to basically get relegated three times before you fall out of Europe. And if you won your domestic league but weren't actually already in the European stuff, you'd start in the bottom league and have to climb back up. It still feels like quite a closed shop, really.
Mm.
And I don't think that's going to wash with a lot of fans around Europe who'll continue to want the idea that your team can progress through, you know, merit, I guess, even if it gives some semblance of that. I think the big thing is, I mean, I've seen the UK government have also released a statement and, you know, via the Independent. And I mean, it basically sounds like they're just going to do everything they can to say no. They'll just kind of create legislation that means that, you know, this version of it, whatever, you know, probably won't be able to take off. I mean, it's interesting what you say about, you know, a Saudi style live style kind of breakaway, because you do get the feeling that that money is sitting there and they're waiting, and at some point money will talk, I guess.
Well, but yeah, I mean, the statement from Alexander Seferin, who is the head of UEFA president, he says, "We will not try to stop them. They can create whatever they want. I hope they start their top competition as soon as possible with two clubs. Football is not for sale." Like, listen, I'm no fan of the Super League conceptually, or certainly the way that it was foisted upon fans. And I know you feel very strongly about that. And the way it, you know, came to pass was quite unpleasant, really, in the grand scheme of things. But it is, you know, there's a sort of arrogance, isn't there, to the way that UEFA operate, the way FIFA operate. Football is not for sale, says Alexander Seferin, as we're about to enter a new, Champions League format coming in next year, which, you know, increases the amount of games that are being played. The only reason that's being done is so they can charge more for TV rights. He's been part, I guess, of the Club World Cup. These moves, to suggest that football is not for sale. Football is not for sale by you, but it's okay for us, is basically the message I get from that.
Yeah. I mean, football is always for sale. I mean, it's perpetually in, you know, cycles where more money is pouring in and coming from new sources and all the rest of it. I think we shouldn't be opposed to change. You know, I'm not standing here and going, well, you know, UEFA are the, you know, this is the people who should be running the game, and they 100% are getting everything right. And I think they've kind of held their hands up and said, yeah, we're, you know, we've made mistakes in the past and whatnot. But I just don't feel like I trust the clubs at the very top to be the ones who are going to somehow save football for everybody else. I just, you know, as much as I love the idea of Arsenal potentially being one of those big clubs and having a big say, I don't feel like that's a safe way for football to operate. It needs an independent sense of, you know, an authoritative body at the top. But I mean, yeah, this idea that clubs will rule themselves, I mean, that's fine, but not all clubs are going to be, you know, treated similarly.
True. And also, you know, I think there is something to discuss when it comes to, you know, the authority, if you like FIFA, let's say their remit should be the good of the game. Somebody ought to operate in a way that benefits football, not just for the richest clubs or the richest nations, but for everybody. And I suppose they will argue that's what they do, but we all understand the way FIFA operates, and UEFA as well. There's a sort of monopoly over European clubs. You know, I would quite happily see FIFA torn down and rebuilt in a way which is more beneficial and which is fairer to everybody in terms of, you know, how the game operates, distribution of the massive wealth that FIFA generates and all the rest of it. But I don't necessarily see any attempt by a Super League or another body another organization. They are absolutely and purely going to be out for profit because they're not going to set themselves up. Well, we're here to save football. We're here to get as much money as we can out of this competition that we have created. You know, so it's a weird situation to be in where organizations who I don't think operate within the best or don't operate with the best interests of football and footballers and football fans at the heart when they should, they genuinely should, UEFA and FIFA, are now probably the best protection that the game has. You know, it's fucking crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, obviously there was no complete disregard for player welfare in this idea because it adds an extra layer of games in, you know, straight away. Mm. I mean, I think if there was one interesting thing from the proposal that's come out, it's this idea of a kind of free platform that would allow, you know, supporters around the world to watch the matches without having, you know, a subscription fee. Now, great, sounds amazing, but how the hell, you know, how the hell does that actually work? I mean, nothing in life is for free. So, I mean, this idea that you're going to just broadcast, I mean, that's where all the money comes from. How, I mean, yeah, they think people are just going to have adverts and that somehow, you know, big companies are going to advertise and, you know, a few kind of scrolling adverts per game is going to be able to keep this thing going. I mean, that's nonsense, really. So they're kind of, you know, I think what they've done is they've pitched a couple of ideas that they think might win over supporters. But really, I think once you dig a little deeper, there's so many questions that you have to ask about how, you know, practical, how it would work on a practical level.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's mad. But look, I think we're going to get kind of 48, 72 hours of noise around this now.
Hmm.
And I think it's going to go quite quiet, quite quickly, would be my take.
Yeah, because like you say, beyond Barcelona, Real Madrid and Juventus, who've kind of stuck to their guns, if that's the way you want to put it, or who are so invested in this thing working because of their own financial situations, the Premier League clubs have already signed their agreements, haven't they, not to do anything ever again and blah, blah, blah. So I don't really know conceptually how this is going to work. But I do wonder if, like I said, I do wonder if it might just be the start of a fracture that could lead somewhere.
Yeah, it could do. I mean, it has just occurred to me, obviously, Juventus had a huge points deduction for, you know, nefarious what's it, you know, going on.
Mm-hmm.
Barcelona being investigated because of, you know, all sorts of stuff with referees and payments made to officials. Real Madrid, who sold their training ground to the local council at a vastly increased, you know, rate just so that they could help fund, you know, their Galactico era. I mean, these are clubs who suddenly want to have control of football, and you think, well, do you trust them? I don't trust them.
No. I don't trust anyone.
That's hard to trust anyone.
But yeah.
I mean, these guys in particular, you're not going to be going, oh yeah, we want to get into bed with you. I mean, also, do we need more football? Like, I love football, and there's loads of it. There's so much football.
Yeah.
But I don't think we actually need more. you know, I don't hear people going, God, I wish there was even more football on TV right now. I mean, football is great. It's amazing. But in the same way, you kind of, you want to have a moment to rest and reflect and actually enjoy what's happened previously. You know,
sure.
If you just kind of straight from one season into the next, you don't actually have that opportunity to really bask in any successes you might have and all the rest of it. Straight away, you're back onto the, you know, oh God, well, we've got everything to lose again.
Yeah.
And I like having a break in the summer. You know, I like being able to kind of down tools and go, I've had enough football for a bit.
Sure.
It gives, you know, you kind of then look forward to the new season. But this idea that we're just going to kind of, yeah, just have matches all the time, all the time.
Well, I mean, that's it. You know, it's, I think we've gone beyond the point of no return because football generates such massive amounts of income that the more football there is, the more income there is, and the more people who are involved in that side of it can benefit for it. I mean, we did have a question on our Discord for today from Ranbo. He said, thoughts on the new Club World Cup in 2025 and Arsene Wenger's defense of the criticism it got. It's a 32-team tournament to be played every 4 years from 2025. There are criticisms from FIFPro, the players' union, over the increased workload on players. And, you know, like you said, there is no break anymore. Players get a couple of weeks in the summer and then they're back in preseason. They're off on preseason tours and all the rest of it. And look, we've been there and done that and they're good fun, but there is obviously an impact on players. You know, the best players never get any time off during the season because they're playing internationals, whether they're friendlies, whether they're qualifiers, all the rest of it. And Arsene Wenger countered the criticism by saying, in Europe, we're lucky, but it's important we make football really global, as if it isn't already. And this creates another chance for clubs to progress. This is the real target. It will give more opportunities to more players all over the world to compete at the highest level. I accept the football calendar is a busy one, but this is a competition that's going to take place every 4 years. And the rest period during the competition and afterwards has to be respected. And when it comes to player welfare, Arsene Wenger says that injury prevention, because of improvements in medicine, has increased dramatically. He also says it is unrecognizable from what it used to be. Also, VAR has helped with the protection of players, as players know they cannot escape from making bad tackles that cause injury. I mean, has Arsene Wenger watched any Premier League football in the last 6 weeks where players are being allowed hit each other in, or hit, you know, their opponents in the head without any significant sanction, despite the fact that we have VAR and we have you know, all these replays which show these acts of violent conduct continuing to go, dangerous violent conduct as well. You know, hitting people in the head is bad. You know, if this is MMA podcast, then hitting people in the head is a good thing. In football and in most walks of life, hitting people in the head is very bad and very dangerous, because most of the time when you get hit in the head, you're not expecting it. At least if you're standing there in a ring or an octagon with some gloves on, you're open to the fact that somebody is going to hit you in the head, not snidely take you out from behind. So, you know, what do you make of Arsene's justification for this competition that nobody needs or wants or has asked for ever?
I mean, it's just a FIFA power play, really, isn't it? It's an attempt to kind of stamp their mark on a club game because they're so well known for what they do with the International World Cup and all the rest of that. But yeah, it feels a bit of a land grab. I haven't even dug down into how you qualify for it. I assume by winning, you know, European honours or, you know, continental honours. But this idea that it gives players from around the world the opportunity to play at the highest level. Sure, maybe. Who's going to win this tournament? It's not going to be the team that comes from Oceania. It's not going to be the team that comes from the Far East, I don't think. It's going to end up being Real Madrid. It's going to end up being, you know, the big
City.
European clubs, probably.
Yeah.
You know, maybe once in a blue moon, you might get a South American team that wins it. But really, I mean, the reason those teams are strong is because their domestic leagues are strong. That's where the money is. That's where the players go. This is just, you know, it's just dressing it all up, really, isn't it? It's kind of, it's the next step on from having friendly matches in the United States is to try and take something competitive there. And obviously the European clubs, they may have flirted with taking domestic football abroad.
Mm.
You know, we've seen it with a couple of the Super Cups and stuff in other countries. But I think the idea of the 39th game or whatever it was that, that used to happen in the Premier League has pretty much been put to bed. I think the Premier League realises it doesn't need that. But this is just a way round it. Create a new tournament that creates some sense of competition and then flog it to the highest bidder, which in this instance it must have been, you know, the US, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, the US are hosting the 2025 tournament.
So I think, is it maybe linked to the fact that they've got the World Cup coming up?
Yes.
Because I vaguely remember them saying that the Confederations Cup, which was always seen as a kind of tester event, wasn't it, for whichever country was hosting the World Cup, has kind of been shelved, basically. So FIFA has said, we'll get rid of the Confederations Cup, which in itself was a completely pointless tournament, mm-hmm. really, that didn't have any weight. And instead, they're just going to jump in on the club game and try and create something that, I guess, probably generates a lot of money for them because there'll be big TV contracts again. That's how you fund these things.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really interest me at all. I mean, I assume they're going to get rid of this current version of the Club World Cup or whatever that City are playing in, the modern version of the Intercontinental Cup, whatever it was. But no English football fan kind of hold, you know, particularly gives too much weight to this idea that City are going to be crowned the best team in the world now as a consequence of beating Fluminense or whoever it is they're playing.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those games, you know, the European Super Cup game that takes place, you know, between the winners of the Europa League now, isn't it? Europa League and Champions League. It used to be the UEFA Cup and the European Cup and the Club World Cup game that goes on. Like I'm aware of it every year, but like it's so far down my list of things I give a single shit about that I could not tell you, you know, who won it last year, who won it the year before, who's won it the most times. I presume it's Real Madrid who've won it the most times. You know, and it's not something that if Arsenal never won it, I would be upset about. I want us to win a Champions League. Badly, because that's a competition that has, you know, been part of our lives and all the rest of it. But these games, they just really, they don't matter. They're just a little bit of a spectacle, but ultimately it's not a trophy you grow up dreaming of winning. You know, it's about your domestic league. It's about your European competitions, and internationally, obviously you want to win, you know, the World Cups and the European Championships, if that's relevant to you and from your part of the world. But these guys just...
I mean, the other thing is, I mean, if you're holding it every 4 years, I mean, you either go in on it and do it or don't. But this idea that it's going to be a kind of every 4 years, teams may have won the trophy that qualifies them to it a couple of years before, potentially.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have that cycle of excitement that's actually relevant. You know, you could almost be irrelevant by that point and still taking part in this tournament. And I don't think what you're going to see is that clubs are any more inclined to try and win this over winning the Champions League, for example. You know, if you win the Champions League one season and then go straight off and then find out that you're beaten by some team that wasn't in the Champions League but is in this, I don't know. It just confuses things, really.
Yeah.
I'll be really curious because actually, you know, if Arsenal did something this season, you know, did win the league, did go, you know, very well in Europe, there's a potential that we could actually be invited to it. And I'd be really curious to see how I feel about that once it gets going, because I just feel like
I think it is
interested, but not like, you know, in anything more, you know, than that. You know, I'd still want us winning the Premier League. I'd still want us winning, you know, domestic honours first and foremost.
Well, what would we be saying? I don't quite understand, or I haven't really looked at how the qualification works, but I guess it's to do with winners of the Champions League and European coefficients and maybe winners of domestic leagues and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if they've already got their teams lined up for the 2025 tournament. But, like, what would we be talking about in the summer of 2025 if Arsenal were involved in that? Would it be like, ooh, I hope Arsenal do well in this? Or is it like, well, this is not really ideal in terms of how you prepare for a new domestic season and hopefully a new season in whatever fucking format the Champions League is in at that point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine that instead of a proper preseason, what you're getting is a team racing straight from a full 38-game domestic league calendar and all the cup competitions and everything else straight into this, and then they're going to get 3 weeks break and then they're going to start the Premier League again. And you're thinking, great, well, we're on the back foot when Burnley come to the Emirates on the first day of the season because our players are fucking knackered.
Yeah, or injured because they played internationals until the middle of June.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're going to need squads that are huge to be able to cope with that, because it's unfair to have a 25-player squad and ask those guys to basically carry 80, 90 games a season, I think.
Isn't that something Mikel Arteta talked about a couple of weeks ago? He was asked about it at his press conference, and I think he made the point that the increased demands on players, you know, will lead to the need for bigger squads. And 25-man squad is quite big as it is, you know, especially as each of those players is going to earn, you know, millions of pounds every year, you know, on a scale from quite many millions to lots of millions, depending on how good they are. Clearly, there might be an increase in income or cash flow if you are involved in these tournaments. But the reality of basically playing 11 and a half months of the year is going to lead to, more injuries, or in order to avoid injury, you're going to have bigger squads with, I suppose, not as much drop-off between certain areas of the squad as there might be right now, where you have like a first choice and then there's sort of like a backup. You're going to essentially need two first choices in every position.
Yeah, and the thing is that if you introduce that for the teams that are, you know, at the very highest level, you have to introduce it for everyone. And then that puts a massive financial strain on other clubs further down the pecking order, because they're thinking, well, we've got to have a 35, 40-man squad. These are clubs who are barely, you know, barely making any money as it is. I mean, who knows? It just opens up a whole can of worms there, I think. The financial pressures on smaller clubs to create squads that are capable of competing, because you have that leeway, or you just end up with the big teams have all of the best players and they even more entrench themselves because they're able to afford, you know, squads that are competitive at a much higher level. Who knows? I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to happen, you know, straight away, but you definitely get the feeling that they'll push for bigger squads at some point soon. I mean, it's already happening, isn't it? I mean, we'll see. I mean, there's a lot going on, but it would also take, I think with all of these changes, it's going to take a lot of time and everything will end up getting watered down bit by bit. We'll see.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, obviously, next season we've got a new format of the Champions League, and when you look at it, it's sort of a real head scratcher. This Swiss league, and or not Swiss league, the Swiss style format of the competition, where everybody's in one giant league and all the rest of it, and it just looks a bit complicated. And I wonder whether, you know, these new guys are kind of looking at that coming in and hoping that it doesn't go down very well with supporters, and they're kind of sitting there waiting with, you know, alternatives waiting. But
I mean, that sort of new Champions League format feels, even if it was in the pipeline before the European Super League, it feels like a reaction to that. You know, you want a Super League? Okay, here it is. We'll just modify the format of the Champions League. You know, which used to be a knockout competition between the champions of all the European leagues. And, you know, of course, over time it has changed. And that's the thing about the way things change, is it's not like, right, tomorrow we're going to do this and this and this and this and this. And everyone's like, what? It's sort of like, it's incremental. It's drip, drip. It's sort of, you know, modified and altered. And then all of a sudden you look back and go, whoa, this is very different from where we were.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Champions League did introduce at one point, didn't it, a second group stage?
Yes.
Because they were trying to get more kind of games in there. And that just ended up, you know, people weren't interested. It was just really tiresome. Qualifying from one group to go into another group to play more, you know, it just became a bit too much. And I think They reversed it actually. So it's possible that they may try this and realize that it's not gone down well with supporters and end up falling back into some other format again. Mm. We'll see.
All right, well, let's move on. And this week was the fourth anniversary of Mikel Arteta's appointment as Arsenal manager, December 20th, 2019, when he took over. And a lot has happened, it's fair to say, in that time. But I think what's perhaps most striking about the situation or where we are now, when you look back on it and you look at what he said he was hoping to do, or what he was going to do, or the things that he wanted to implement at the football club. When you look back, he's basically done that right across the board. Like, he has been absolutely true to his word about what he expects from not just his players, but from everybody around him in terms of staff and all the rest. Have you, you know, I think when you're in it, and when you're in it perhaps as much as we are, in that we do it every day, and so like you go to the game on a Saturday and then you don't think about football again until next weekend or you know, the midweek game or whatever it is. Again, you're sort of embroiled in it all the way through, so you sort of live it, experience it, and all the rest. But I did find it quite interesting going back to read and look at what he said, you know, in his first press conference, and just go, fuck. Like,
the man had a plan.
He had a very, very serious plan, which he has implemented. It hasn't been easy, and you know, there have been ups and downs, but he has not deviated, I don't think, in any way from what he said he was going to do 4 years ago.
I mean, deeply impressive, that to have that kind of foresight, and then not just to be able to have the plan, but to be able to implement it through the chaos.
Yes.
And really, it really was chaos. I mean, the club was in a bit of a mess, you know, the tail end of the Arsene years, the Unai situation, all the stuff that was going on at boardroom level, this idea that we were going to have a four-person team that would somehow oversee how everything was going to run. To come, you know, to pick up the pieces of all of that, have a very clear plan, and to drag those who wanted to come with him and to kick out those who didn't want to come along the way is just, it's deeply impressive. It's like if you did that in any business, you would be, you know, you'd be a superstar. Mm. And to do it in the madness of football, against the constant questioning of everything that you're doing, you really need to be quite stubborn. Both you and Tim this week, I think, have written, or in the last couple of days have written stuff looking back at what he said. And it's just, I can't say I thought he'd implement everything, but he has managed to pretty much do that. Mm. And if we think that he was probably working to a 5-year plan and we're into year four, you could imagine on that plan that year four he'd penciled in win the Premier League, year five win the Champions League. You know, it was sort of first year we're going to sort things out, second year we're going to get back into it, third year we're going to get into the Champions League, fourth year, you know, that kind of like markers. And well, we're in the mix. I mean, you can't make that happen just because, you know, you've got loads of other clubs who are trying to stop that from happening. But we are very much in the mix in a way that I just did not see us being at one point. As you said, I mean, after the first year, he may easily have been sacked. Mm-hmm. So I think some credit has to go to the club for also, I think what they could see was that this guy was implementing stuff. And even though the results on the pitch weren't necessarily showing, they could see the culture within the club changing.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the resetting and rebuilding of the culture at the club has been just so unbelievably impressive. Because, you know, things happen at football clubs and, you know, everyone, I think, tries to do their best. Well, you know, look at something like Manchester United now. And, you know, they make these decisions. And, you know, from the outside, we can look back and say, well, that's crazy. You know, what are they doing? It's very funny to see them like that and all the rest of it. But, you know, ultimately, there are people at that football club that want that football club to do well and to succeed. But they just can't do it at this moment in time. but you know where we were, the divisiveness after the end of the Arsene Wenger era, the ill fit of Unai Emery, and I think perhaps the way that the club was structured at that time didn't really help Emery, didn't really help the players, didn't help anybody achieve what this club wants to achieve. And I think what struck me most was, you know, we talked about Arsenal being at kind of like a rock bottom. This is, you know, awful. This is, you know, the only way is up from here. But where we fell to was eighth in the Premier League. And there are clubs who would bite your hand off to finish eighth one season, to aim for and sort of finish consistently in the European places. Lots of clubs would love to have that as their baseline, you know, and that's something I don't think that many clubs can achieve. And then we as Arsenal fans are talking about, well, we need to get back to where we were. We need to win things. We need to win the Premier League. It's been too long, and it has been. I completely get that. But there is a sort of privilege that comes with supporting a club who has realistic ambitions of winning the Premier League. Because most of the clubs in the Premier League do not have that. And there is an inherent privilege that comes with it. And I think Arteta understands that, or understood that there is, we're in a very special position, that 95% of football fans will never have that possibility in their football supporting lives. You know, if you win on a Saturday, you know, that might be as good as you get if you're supporting a club, you know, down the leagues or from your local town or hometown or whatever it might be. But as Arsenal, as a football club that, you know, has the resources and has the history and has the tradition of being able to challenge for the Premier League title, I think what he fundamentally understood was that in order to respect that privilege, you've got to put in the work and you've got to put in the dedication, and you can't swan about and you can't just turn up and you can't pick and choose your games and you can't be 99% one day and 80% another day. He wants you to be 100% all of the time, because that is the only way that you can actually respect that privilege properly.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we went from being a club that expected to challenge for the title to a club that was happy to finish in the top four. And the moment you settle for finishing in the top four, standards drop because you're accepting that you're not going to be the best. And I think Arteta, from the get-go, said, we have to compete at the top. That sets the standards. That tells everybody this is where we have to be. We won't accept 7 out of 10 performances in training. We won't accept, you know, occasionally losing away from home against a big team. You know, actually what you've got to do is get everybody believing again. I have to say, towards the end of the Wenger era, obviously during Unai's time, that I kind of got to the point where I didn't start seasons thinking Arsenal were going to win the league anymore. And that was quite depressing. Whereas in the space of 3 years, we've got to a situation where, 4 years, that, you know, this year I genuinely believed, and I think the squad was there and it's been created and set up with winning the league in mind. What I would say is you absolutely cannot rest on your laurels from here. We're in a good place now, but Arteta is absolutely central to everything as far as I'm concerned. You know, he's the guy who's driving the train. If he goes, what happens? And I think the club has to be massively ready for that moment, because at some point he's going to go, but you can't just allow everything to fall apart off the back of that. You need to have everything in place, ready, waiting. You need to have everybody in the club on the same line, ready to basically pick up the pieces. And that's the bit that I kind of want to see from, you know, I want to know and trust that the club and everybody behind Arteta is kind of capable of being in that position, because, you know, he's not going to be around forever.
I think that's true. You know, it is a bit sort of like, I don't know what it's like. You're sort of looking for the worst case scenario a little bit. But, you know, I know what you're saying. Absolutely. I do know what you're saying. But maybe this is one of those things where it's really difficult to actually prepare for that? When you have somebody as singular as Mikel Arteta has been at Arsenal, like, where do you go from there? I don't know. I mean, there's always good managers and good coaches and things like that. And you would hope that, you know, lessons will have been learned about, you know, processes and how you make decisions and how you recruit not just players, obviously, but executive level or manager level and all the rest of it. But I do think that, you know, people had worries, didn't they, when he became manager? We're going back to the same thing again, where all the power is in one man, like it was under Arsene Wenger. And I don't think it's quite that. I think he's obviously a very powerful figure at Arsenal, a very influential figure at Arsenal. But I think there have been put in place enough structures and other people around that it's not just, well, one man is responsible for pretty much everything that goes on in football. I think there is some demarcation in that sense.
Yeah. I think the other thing I'm trying to get at really is building the connection between the players and the fans, and just putting the fans at the center of everything has been a vital part of his success. And at no point should the club forget that the fans have played a massive role in driving this forward. And the club has to continue to respect the supporters and has to continue putting the fans at the centre of everything, because if the fans are on board, it's going to make life easier for whoever is in charge. And I just hope they remember that. I don't want them resting on their laurels. I don't want them, you know, oh, we had a season of the Ashburton Army in the crowd and the atmosphere got really, really good. And we're just like, great, we've completed, you know, having a good atmosphere. It doesn't work like that. Mm. It's got to be an ongoing kind of process. And they should be looking into any which way they can to keep this going. And I hope they are. You know, there are signs that there are some good people working at the club who have the club's best intentions at heart and who I think respect the fans in a way that maybe the fans weren't respected previously. I think Arteta, more than anyone, has respect for the fans, and that's why he's so desperate to you know, bring success to the club. And I honestly, last year was a bonus season, right? We didn't expect anything to play out the way it was. This season, I really want to win. And I, you know, I'll be so happy if he achieves it, because for all the work he's done, he deserves it, and I think we deserve it as well.
I mean, it is the next step, though, isn't it? I think that would be something that he says. Like, I love the fact that we have a competitive team, and I think, you know, the objective part of your brain says, if you are a club that can compete, that can go the distance, you know, to April, May, and be in the mix for the title and hopefully go far in Europe and all those kinds of things, but you're beaten by another very good football team, because that's what happens in football, that's, to me, far preferable than swanning around eighth place or you know, whatever else. Of course it is. But I think what you've said about what Arteta wants and what he demands and what he's looking for from this job and for this football club is the success, the trophies, the thing I think that fans connect with more than anything is success. Like, talk to anyone of a certain age and they'll talk to you all day long about 1994 and winning the European Cup Winners' Cup, or winning the league at White Hart Lane, or winning the league at Old Trafford, or, you know, FA Cup wins that people have experienced over the last number of years. You know, those successes, those titles, Anfield 89, of course, and, you know, if you go back all through the years, the moments that really, really stick with fans as a collective are those successes. And I think that is, you know, beyond the, like, I want to win every football game. If we win every football game, we will win something at the end of the season. Beyond just the competitive nature of the sport itself and what you're looking for as professional athletes and professional footballers, you know, I think his real desire is to, you know, to stand there maybe at Islington Town Hall and hold up a trophy and there's 200,000, 250,000, however many people on Upper Street, you know, cheering and singing and enjoying that sort of collective success together, because those are the memories that remain. They're sort of immortal, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's the legacy, right? That's when you write yourself into the history books, because this is all well and good, but if Arsenal end up coming second, third, fourth, fifth, you know, over the course of the next six or seven seasons, even if we're competitive, ultimately he'll go down as a guy who did a good job, but not a great job.
Yeah.
Even though we know in the moment what he's done has been very, very impressive, but it has to be. You have to win trophies, and then suddenly you're the man. And he could go down as one of the greats if he can get over the line a couple of times, you know, because I think where he's come from, he's had to pick up the pieces as kind of Arsene did a little bit as well. You know, he was kind of picking up the pieces, and Herbert Chapman in the 20s and 30s had to kind of come into a club.
George Graham, you know, people have talked about the sort of similarities between George Graham and Mikel Arteta in that they were former players. They came in and they were, you know, ruthless and stone cold in their decision making. And, you know, I think, you know, this season and next season are going to be absolutely fascinating, because I'm not saying it's easy to go from eighth to fifth, and it's certainly not easy to go from fifth to second, and certainly not in the way that we did it last season. But, you know, the final push to go from runner up one season to title winner the following season is, whoa. That is some traffic outside your place. What was that? That was like a F-15 bomber or something. Holy shit.
Yeah.
But
vehicles on bikes.
Yeah. But, you know, that push to get that extra 5 points, 6 points, that extra 1%, 2%, whatever it might be, that might require the most ruthlessness and stone coldness of all time, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, Manchester City can afford to have periods where they might get a transfer wrong or something. I don't think we can do that. I mean, we haven't actually mentioned the fact that the club have really backed him with money, or the Cronkies have really backed him with money. I've been their biggest critics, but they have given him the resources he needs to buy the players he wants to work a system that he's, you know, positive will make the difference between us coming fourth and coming first. So I give credit to them as well. I've completely gone off the point that you were just
talking about making that final step and what he is willing to do to make that happen in terms of how he builds his squad. Maybe we're seeing something of that in the Raya Ramsdale situation this season, where it's like, you know, thank you got us this far. Maybe in our minds the difference between Raya and Ramsdale is not that great. Maybe it's the same for Mikel Arteta, where he thinks, well, it's not huge. It's not a massive gulf. It's not like going from, from rock bottom to the very top or anything like that. But it might just be he feels the 2% or 3% that he needs to win us a few extra points in a season, which might be the difference between second and first.
Yeah. I mean, I think towards the tail end of last season, he was asked about whether there were new things that he wanted to try. And he said, absolutely, but I can't do it now because we're right in the middle of, you know, chasing a title. And I think in the summer, with some of the recruitment, particularly with Timber, I think what we were going to see was going to be an evolution of the way we play. And I think we have seen an evolution, this idea of Arsenal being more in control of games. But I think what's exciting is that there's probably more things he wants to explore. And we have to remember he's only been a coach for the 4 years that he's actually been with us. So he's learning along the way as well. And I'm excited to see, you know, the potential kind of for him to kind of explore new things that we haven't even thought of. You know, I think that's really, really exciting. And I think he's learning. I think he knows he's made mistakes along the way. I think we can all point to some of those, you know, the bad buys. I think there have been moments maybe in the press where he's kind of done things that he probably shouldn't have done. I'm not entirely, this actually leads us a little bit to the Anfield thing. I think in the past when he's made a big deal about things, actually it's ended up backfiring. We've probably placed too much emphasis on them, like the Anfield atmosphere and the way that he tried to sort of prepare the players with the
speakers, you
know,
and
the speakers and all that. I know, I get it. It's a kind of gimmick as an idea. It was something, but really what's happened is the press have latched onto it. They've seen it. And they now think that this is, you know, something they have to ask Arsenal about every time they go to Anfield, you know, all the big atmosphere and all the rest of it. The Liverpool fans now think that they've got this thing over us because they're going to create the bigger atmosphere. And, you know, the little learning things that I think he's picked up probably over the the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It's just really exciting and just so much better than it was a few years ago.
Of course.
It was miserable.
Yeah.
It really was miserable. And like when you're actually, as you say, we're in it every day, you can't really escape that. And it just kind of becomes a little bit overwhelming and sad. So to have the excitement back, I have to say a huge thank you to Michael Otero if he's listening. Yeah.
So far, so good. And of course he's listening, I'm sure. You know, what else? What else would he be doing with his time?
Friend of the podcast, or friend of the site. You know, we've been there.
I suspect, though, in the next couple of days, he might have, you know, more important fish to fry when it comes to this game against Liverpool. I don't want to go too deep into it because we will be talking about it tomorrow on Patreon as we do our usual Premier League preview podcast. But, you know, in a season where we've beaten Manchester City for the first time, under Mikel Arteta, it's not like we haven't beaten Liverpool. We have, but we haven't beaten Liverpool away for quite some time. It feels like if this is going to be the season, if this is going to be the time where we find that extra 1-2%, those extra few points that might get us to the title, this game could be one of those where people look back on and say, that was a moment for this Arsenal team. It does feel like that kind of game to me.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think last year beating them at home was a massive, because it felt like we were announcing ourselves on the big stage. You know, they had a bit of a hex over us for a while. So to overcome that was a big step. The one thing we haven't done yet is go to City or go to Liverpool under Arteta and win. And the best Arsenal sides have managed to do that. You know, wins at Liverpool tend to mark a very important stake in the season, right? It's the stake in the ground, sorry. You know, we did it with the 2002 team, didn't we? Memorably when Lundberg scored, and that felt like an absolutely massive game around about the same time of season, wasn't it? I mean, if we can get something from the game, I think it will be absolutely huge. The last year we were so close, and there's so much to learn from that game. This idea of kind of racing into it, going up, losing ourselves a little bit and falling apart, because it proved to be very, very damaging. You know, that result got in our head a bit. You know, we had the West Ham, we had the Southampton, and everything fell apart. I feel like everything we've done this season is gearing up to games like this, the control element, right? We don't need to go gung-ho. We don't need to win 4-0. What we need is to strangle the game. What's frustrating so far, I guess, is that in the previous 5:30 Saturday kickoffs, we've lost 1-0 to Newcastle, lost 1-0 to Aston Villa.
Third time lucky.
Well, hopefully, yeah. I mean, there is some extra edge, though, I think, in a crowd for a 5:30 Saturday game, because people have been in the pub longer. There's a bigger atmosphere. Yeah. They want to go for you a bit more. You know, if this was a 12:30 Saturday, I mean, obviously we've been battered by them at 12:30 on a Saturday as well. We've been battered in every single slot that's going. But, it was interesting seeing, obviously, Klopp this week talking about wanting more of an atmosphere from the Liverpool fans. I think he realises that Arsenal are good and that he needs the supporters on board. There's a measure of paying respect, I think, to Arsenal here. They've opened this new stand, and it sounds like everyone's complaining about the atmosphere since. I mean, it's weird. It's two games in a week, and both of them sound like they've been quite, dry occasions. So we've got to counter that somehow. They're going to go for us. But the best way we can do that is have lots of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we have lots of the ball, I think the Liverpool fans will get frustrated. Then we need to be clinical, which is something we've struggled with a little bit. But we have goal scorers.
Yeah. I think we've got the potential to go there and win. For the first time, I just went back to have a look since September 2012.
Yeah, it was the Derby game, wasn't it, when he ran the show in midfield.
Yeah, goals from Podolski and Cazorla. So it's overdue, I think it's fair to say. It's overdue.
Yeah, a decade.
So, yeah, fingers Over a crossed. Decade. All right. Well, look, like I said, we'll talk a bit more about that game tomorrow on Patreon for our Patreon members. For now, though, we'll leave it there. Andrew, as ever, thank you very much and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, and to everyone listening. Yeah, look forward to seeing some of you at the stadium over the coming weeks.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Thank you very much indeed to Andrew. You can find him on Twitter. He is at @AAllenSport, at @AAllenSport, and of course doing stuff over on Arsblog News. So I think that is just about that for this week's show. We talked about Mikel Arteta. We talked about the 4 years that he's been in charge. We've talked about the many and varied positive things that he has done for the football club. But I think one of my favorite things is the fact that he's developed a, you know, in recent times, a little bit of a vocal tic, you know, which can happen when you're around people. They speak in a certain way. You pick up little sayings, bit of the accent, inflections, that kind of thing. And Mikel Arteta dropping an "in it" every now and again just never fails to raise a smile.
You can always get better in life, innit?
That's not possible. It's like in the game, I give the lineup, then we don't win, and I say, "Would you do the same one?" Yeah. Easy, innit?
So let's hope that the next 4 years of Mikel Arteta's tenure at Arsenal are absolutely filled with both trophies and innits. I am 100% here for all of that. Please do join us on Patreon tomorrow as we look ahead to the Liverpool game. Patreon.com/Arsblog. It's a little over £5 a month. You get to support everything that we do on the site, as well as getting bonus exclusive content every single week. So if you fancy it, it is patreon.com/Arsblog. We will, as I said, have an Arscast extra for everybody, free to the world on Christmas Eve. So join myself and James for that. Keep fingers crossed that it's as good as we all want it to be, and we can go on and enjoy our Christmases and all the rest with 3 points in the bag. So let's leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for listening. We will catch you on the next one, folks. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. Coming up this weekend on the UEFA Complete Universal National Trophy. 72 teams playing 72 games in 72 hours. All playing for the biggest prize in football that nobody gives a fuck about. Coverage starts at 3 a.m. Join presenter Richard Keys with expert punditry from Joey Barton, John Terry, and AI Genghis Khan. This show is sponsored by Tesla, the electric cars that don't catch fire.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.